McKinnon Legal Podcast, your guide to brighter paths beyond challenging marriages. Here's your host, Christina McKinnon.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. This morning, we have a very distinguished guest, someone in my book who I consider a mentor, whether she knew it or not, Maria Gonzalez, who is a board-certified marital and family law attorney here in South Florida, actually throughout the entire state of Florida. Today will be a part two of our initial podcast, which was how to be a great guardian ad litem, or what to expect when working with a guardian ad litem. This is someone certainly who is a practicing family law attorney, but also works as a mediator, as well as a guardian ad litem. Maria, thank you and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for the nice comments. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. So the first time we had, I guess it was part one of this series, I went through a lot of the factors in the statute. I went through what to expect, but I want to educate the listeners a little bit on what to expect from an actual guardian, from someone who's actually in the position or serves in this position doing it, what you feel that your duties are, and then if you are a litigant or a practicing attorney listening today, if you have a guardian ad litem report that is, you know, not in your client's favor, how do you attack the credibility? What holes should you look for? How could you identify if a guardian ad litem has gone rogue? So the first question, what are the requirements for being a guardian ad litem?
Well, for being a guardian ad litem, we have under Chapter 61, there's a specific statute that creates us, right? Creates the guardian ad litem and has powers and duties and requirements, what you can do and what you cannot do. So one of the main things is you have no authority to do anything until the order is signed and you do an oath and acceptance. And a lot of times folks forget that and they want you to jump on board. If it's an emergency and you have a case in family court and also domestic violence, perhaps in the same family, it's important you get a court order in both divisions. So that's it's an oversight that sometimes happens. You cannot just willy-nilly just go and start doing anything. Likewise, once you're discharged and there's an order of discharge after your duties are done and completed, you cannot be called and said, hey, you need to go out and see this child or you need to interview the father or the mother.
Right.
You have no power to do anything. So it happens very often that you can't act until there's proper papers in place. The duties are really, really spelled out. What is it that you're investigating? It's important to look at that order. Am I looking at time sharing? Am I looking at, is it a relocation case? Is it a relocation case on a temporary basis or the full-blown final type of relocation? All of those matter because you as a guardian have to look at the factors. And if you have a relocation, you have an additional set of factors that you have to chime in on. And your report, there's a written report that has to really chime in on what your investigation revealed. What are the strengths or weaknesses of either parent to be able to meet those factors and meet the needs of these particular minor children? Mm-hmm. So the duties include, like I said, time sharing, creation of a parenting plan, assisting with that. What type of telephone contact or other type of electronic communication should be in place for the children? Do we have special needs children? Mm-hmm. Are there therapies that are not being met? All of those things, it's a really big net of information. The lawyers, it's very important to gather what you believe is important for the guardian to review. Gather whatever pleadings, orders, temporary agreements, any other stipulations. The guardian needs to and must receive notice of all the hearings, depositions, and they're a party. So that's another very important thing. You know, you don't want to have a mediation set with everyone and then the guardian hasn't even been contacted. They need to be perhaps present, maybe some of the time, maybe all of the time for that mediation, but it's a very integral part. So I'm going to stop a moment to see if you have any specific questions and then I can zone in on your questions.
Yeah, most importantly that I was unaware that the guardian also had to be injured in a domestic violence case. So thank you for that tidbit. but they are a party to the case, which is very important. Most people don't understand. They think that they're just another expert that can be deposed or as a witness, but you're an actual party to the case. So what does that mean for our lay people that are out there listening?
Well, it means that you're a very important piece of this puzzle here. The hearings cannot just proceed with the way it was prior to the appointment of a guardian. Someone either, and let me back up. How did the guardian even get appointed? Sometimes it's sua sponte. The judge, you know, I have been in courtrooms where the judge looks back and says, Ms. Gonzalez, you're now a guardian because I just heard this argument and I need a guardian. Other times the judge will ask both attorneys to, you know, exchange names amongst themselves to have someone. Oftentimes you have a very contested hearing as to one party says, I need a guardian. We need a guardian for these children. And the other side says, nope, we absolutely do not. And then you also have the other layer of, well, should you have a guardian ad litem or a social investigator? And that's a separate issue as to which type of expert you would want. So there's a lot of information flowing between the two lawyers to assess a case and say, do we need a guardian? If so, you know, let's consider who would be the fit for this particular family. And are they available? Sometimes, you know, you got to turn away cases because you have too many at one time and you can't address it.
Okay. Now, I want to ask you, Maria, what do you require from the actual litigants? Do you require a witness list? Do you require documentation? What do you require from them at the inception of the case?
They are immediately notified, both attorneys and the parties, that contact list. Who do you think is important? And I tell the parties, don't put 25 names if three or four are going to tell me the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. Because it's resources. And, you know, once you give me a list as a guardian, I'm required to contact those folks. Right. So give me important people. What did, you know, especially persons who were on the ground, were there and verbally or, you know, visually participated, saw and were aware and actually experienced things, right? That are part of the allegations. So a contact list is hugely important. Also releases and consents. If there are therapists already on board for the children, I can't talk to them. Sometimes some schools are unbelievable. Sometimes I can contact the teachers and give them a copy of my order. Sometimes I have to go through administration. Sometimes I have to go up even further and get the legal attorney for the school on board. And I cannot even speak to a teacher. Exactly. I have a Zoom with the lawyer for the school present. So it's the gamut. It just runs the gamut.
And that's the same thing with DCF as well. DCF won't speak to the attorneys even. You have to speak with their lawyers first. So it's hard to get reports. It's hard to speak with the investigators.
Let me chime in on that, on the DCF. Sometimes I have very much cooperation and sometimes I don't. So I don't have the power to be issuing subpoenas. I just get both attorneys, speak to them and say, look, I'm having a problem. Can one of you issue a subpoena? Because I need those DCF narratives and I'm entitled to them, but I'm just not getting them and they can get it for me. So yeah, paperwork is important. Also accessibility, home visits take place. So I need to go to both of the homes. I usually first meet with each of the parents one-on-one separately. Mm-hmm. And then at that meeting, I coordinate the home visit and then I go and those are announced. And then I can do unannounced ones. I can just show up and say, I'm here to visit, you know, see the children or to speak to one of the parents. If there's issues of, you know, alcohol, substance abuse, other type of issues, you may want to do an unannounced visit at one of the homes. And then I also visit with the children outside of the home in some sort of a social setting, a park, somewhere, you know, where they feel comfortable. I generally avoid having anything in meetings in my office. I think it's very stale for that. So I usually either do the, you know, meet with them and speak initially in the home visit. And then I use the word home study and I did not mean that. I meant a home visit or in a public place that I feel is, you know, conducive and right for the age of the children.
Understood. Now, after you do your report, how long does it take for you to promulgate your report, typically?
It's a very it's a very lengthy process because by then, if I'm getting ready to write a report, that means someone has either already noticed the case for trial and there's a date, or there's just a request for a trial date. So at that point, once a trial date has been requested, I start to work up on a report. But I don't do that without conversing with both attorneys as well, because the clients will be incurring a lot of expense for a report. So oftentimes I don't do a report for mediation. I do a bullet point or I have a meeting with both of the attorneys and then I meet with both of the parties and say, this is where my investigation is. This is where my, you know, recommendations are. If you ask me to do a full report, this is where it's going to, what it looks like right now. But I have to have at that point concluded, you know, all my investigation. Sometimes there are witnesses, contacts that don't respond. They're just, for whatever reason, they just delay, and they're important people that I need to talk to. So, you know, sometimes it's a psychiatrist, sometimes it's a psychologist. I can't do a final report without speaking to the children's psychologist. So, you know, arrangements need to be made for that to happen. And also, the guardian can do interim. You mentioned a report, but they can do interim reports, which is very important. And sometimes it helps and alleviates putting out fires and kind of says, okay, let's look at this. It's an important issue right now. And sometimes that alleviates other issues that, you know, would have come up afterward, but for the interim recommendations.
Okay. All righty. Now, after the report is either filed or given to the parties, which do you prefer? I don't know if the court requires you to file it.
I don't give it to the parties. I give it to the attorneys, and then they are to, you know, just discuss it with their clients. I am required to file it with the court. The judge is not going to look at it. It's just going to get in the docket. Then everybody can argue hearsay. That's another issue for the order itself. The hearsay waiver, is it existing or not existing? Right. And that's an evidentiary hearing later. But the report, I am required to give it to both attorneys. And I usually always put a message that the parties are not to converse with the children about this. They're not to announce what the timesharing is recommended. It may be keeping it the same. It may be a drastic change. And those one-sided communications to the children are very, very damaging. So it's important that once the report is out, the lawyers speak to their clients and really emphasize how important it is not to discuss the terms of the report with their children.
Okay. Now, for the attorneys that are listening, what should an attorney do if they get a report that is not, I don't want to say in their client's favor, because the guardian ad litem is appointed for the best interest of the child, but it's not what they were requesting in the pleadings. It's not, you know, what they were requesting. What should they do in terms of getting the best outcome for their client?
Well, that attorney should immediately consider noticing the guardian for deposition. I suggest they also look perhaps at their invoices or billing records and determine how much time was dedicated, for example, to the contact collaterals of the mother or the father or the wife or the husband, so that they can determine maybe the guardian spent, you know, 90% of their time interviewing only the father's side of the collaterals. Maybe the guardian failed to contact some people. That's possible, right? Mm-hmm. So that would be important. If you believe that the guardian has any biases or they did an incomplete type of investigation, that would be very important. And also to plug out, did you consider this? Did you consider that in the scheme of your report? And the depositions usually can, you know, the reports, just to have an idea, are usually 30 to 40 pages. It is a very complicated or lengthy, detailed process because you go through the factors. And that's why I talked about the bullet point earlier. So if you're at that point, you have a full-blown report, you have a rogue guardian, you need to consider seriously doing a deposition to determine and bring out for your trial whether this guardian did their job or did they fail to do completely their job. Because if you discredit the guardian, then you may be able to have a judge say, well, I'm not going to go with the recommendations, right?
Right. And that was my last question, pretty much, is does the judge have to follow your recommendation? You put in all of this work, you've spent months on the case, you've interviewed all the collateral witnesses, the children, the parents, the schools, et cetera. Does the judge automatically go with the recommendation of the guardian?
Absolutely not. The judge is the judge. The judge is there, you know, to consider the evidence. It's not a slam dunk. There's no rubber stamping. There's no stamp that says Maria did a guardian ad litem report and the judge must follow that. No. And the judge will also inquire of the guardian in an evidentiary hearing and also ask questions and concerns. The bottom line is protecting these children. If I have an opinion of the best interest of the children is X, the judge may have a different opinion. You also have ages of these children. You know, the preference of children. Sometimes I reflect it in the report. But sometimes I agree, sometimes I don't. Sometimes the child's preference is not what's in their best interest, which is hard to grasp. It's hard to understand that. sometimes for the parties that the stated preference of a child does not necessarily mean it's in their best interest. Are you going to jump out of the plane with a parachute or without a parachute, right? It's not in your best interest to jump out without the parachute. So the guardian's job, you know, job or duty here is to always keep mindful of the best interests of the children. Okay. And I've had that. I've had it happen. I can vouch for that. I've had some reports where the judge has gone the other way or done like a hybrid, accepted some portions of it, but not some other recommendations. Absolutely happens. Okay. As it should. That's why we have a judge.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for today. I want you to give your information to the listeners that are out there. This is a wonderful guardian ad litem I've used her in the past, and she hasn't always ruled in my favor, but she's done a thorough job. Very impressed with the work and the level of detail in the reports. But on the, of course, the ones that she has gone our way, we were very grateful that our client was able to be reunited with her kids or to relocate with her kids or to have their past orders modified. So if you have any questions, how can they reach you, Maria?
Well, my office is in Miramar, and the office number is 954-874-1653. And we're here to, you know, to serve and assist in any way possible. And thank you for the opportunity. Thank you, Christina.
All right. Thank you for coming on. As everyone knows, that we will be having a myriad of guests throughout the entire year. I'm Christina McKinnon of McKinnon Legal, your marriage expert in South Florida. We are located in West Broward in West Miramar, 305-416-0045. Thank you and have a wonderful day, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the McKinnon Legal Podcast. Remember, there's always a path to a brighter, happier future. Stay tuned for more positive insights on troubled relationships and legal solutions. For more information, please visit McKinnon-legal.com. That's McKinnon-legal.com. Or call 877-920-1614.